Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for that introduction, Clive. And I agree that your criticism of the Commission was entirely unfair in your evidence to the Home Affairs Select Committee. So just be a good chap and sit down. Right. Okay. Now, earlier on this afternoon from Professor Vittori, we had the coffin. Now from the Charity Commission, we've got the entire graveyard at this time of the afternoon on a Friday. So what we will try to do, Michelle and I between us, is to focus perhaps more on sort of themes and concepts rather than on some of the very specific issues and technicalities that we've had in some of the earlier presentations. Not least of which, because while Michelle knows everything, absolutely everything there is to know about charity law, I don't. But I think just to give a flavour of the scale of the sector might be useful for you. In the UK, we've got 164,000 registered charities. That's just registered charities. Not all charities have to be registered. In total, there are about 350,000 of these charities. Annual income of about £64 billion, that's the registered ones. Assets, 186 billion. But it's not an even spread throughout the charities. 80% of the income is accounted for by 3% of the charities. In other words, a very small number of charities account for the overwhelming majority of that £64 billion. So, and it speaks for itself. 78,000 charities, very small, less an income of less than 10,000, but less than 2,000 with an annual income of greater than 1 million. So that gives you an idea of the skewing of the sector. And 13,000 of these charities operate internationally with about £10 billion under their care. Now, why is it that the sector is vulnerable? First of all, the public like charities. They like the whole charitable ethos. There's what's called the halo effect that affects charities. So people want to trust them. And charities, in turn, the vast majority of them, are incredibly trustworthy. Charities do have a global presence, and of course that gives rise to vulnerabilities. And it is a feature as well that very often one or two key individuals can play a disproportionately important role within a charity. Despite all the regulation that there is about trustees and the roles of boards of trustees and so on, it's not uncommon to find that a charismatic person can actually hold sway over the entire charity. And there's a very serious current case that we're looking at the moment where a lot of money donated by the public has gone missing. And where actually it's quite apparent that the Board of Trustees had absolutely no idea of what was going on. They had little idea of what their responsibilities were, and there was one or two people who were responsible for the loss of a huge amount of charitable donations. I think it speaks for itself, the rest of these points. Just the point that it's not meant to be condescending, generally lower levels of regulation in other parts of the world, but the fact is that in the UK, the charitable sector is pretty tightly regulated. There's a great deal of law, both statute and case law, surrounding the regulation of charities, and the fact is that in some areas in the world, it's not quite so clearly defined. And in terms of where charities can fit into the terrorist planning cycle, if you look at it this way, to mount a terrorist attack you need financial and logistical support. The reason you need all that logistical support falls into the areas that I've got in yellow here, and all that needs money. Now that money comes from a range of areas which are set out, and charities are but one of them. Possibly a subject for debate afterwards, perhaps in questions. It's often said that there's an inextricable link between organised crime and charity. Sorry, organised crime and terrorism. There probably isn't an inextricable link between organised crime and charity. Probably one and the same thing. Don't ask me.
That's your next job.
But for a number of reasons, sometimes good, sometimes less than entirely honourable, that connection is made. And I must admit, in my experience over the years, but looking at terrorism and more recently from another angle, I've yet to see that link, possibly with the exceptions of Afghanistan and the heroin trade, and possibly now if you look at ISIL and some of the money that's flowing in to support that, you may say that there's some linkage there, but it's not as clear as some people want to make out, particularly when they're trying to restructure the framework of UK law enforcement. Mrs. May. Now, from a charitable perspective, charities find themselves involved at, if you like, all stages of the movement of cash, the raising, the storing, the moving and the using. There's an involvement of charities at all those stages, so inevitably there are vulnerabilities as well at those stages. We've already heard this afternoon about the Financial Action Task Force. There's a specific recommendation 8 that refers to charities. And I think it's fair to say that we have seen, certainly in respect of Syria, points B and C, we've seen legitimate entities being exploited as conduits for terrorist financing, and we've seen attempts to conceal or obscure the clandestine diversion of funds. Point A is more problematic. We, in terms of UK, and with our definitions, haven't seen that to any great extent. This is really saying that a charity is a sham. Now, in other jurisdictions, there are different definitions, and maybe Jimmy will have a view on this, but for instance, if you take the charity Interpal, which works in Palestine, in the US it's designated. It's not in the UK. And there's a different process in the United States where charities are licensed as opposed to registered. So we have to look for different things. In the United States, it's possible, I understand, to de-license a charity. It's not in the same way here. Unless a charity is a complete sham, we can't just take it off the register. So there's some complications around that. I think this, by and large, speaks for itself. I think it's worth emphasising this third point here, that criminal prosecution is not the only approach to dealing with problems in this area. There are other ways of getting into it as well. Proper task force approach, greater cooperation, I think, is still needed between various government agencies who have traction and information and intelligence in these areas. And it's, you know, to use the old cliche, it's the Al Capone approach to this. There's more than one way of skinning this particular cat. If finance is being channeled through to terrorist organisations, it's the old story of trying to find who is best placed to have the proper effect within the prevailing legal framework. And part of that is sometimes determining which jurisdiction is actually best placed to have an impact. I won't go through again all of this slide. I will point out, though, I think there's a difficult balance here. Because if you over-regulate, what you can end up doing is actually driving the issue underground, and then you lose sight of it, and that puts you into difficult territory. It can have unintended consequences. So you can think you're a very tough regulator, and this is what you've really got to get on top of this, and we're being encouraged to do this, and we are indeed actually becoming a tougher regulator. It's the current strategy of the Charity Commission to improve public confidence in charities by trying to give as much reassurance to the public that we can, that when they give money, that their charitable donations will not be misappropriated. And that's how we fulfil our statutory requirement to increase public confidence in charities, and in that way meet some of the criticisms which justifiably have been levelled at the Commission. Not all of those criticisms, Clive. How do we fit in with the overall UK counterterrorism strategy? Many of you will know that there's a contest strategy, it's called the 4 P's, prevent, prepare, pursue, and the other one,
protect.
And we, in the Charity Commission, try to cut across all of those four P's. I should know those four P's. I was instrumental in drawing some of them out. I wrote some of them. But you see there, fitting in with the legislative framework, the sanctions regime and our own regulatory work as a commission. And our own counter-terrorism strategy has those strands across the bottom, and Michelle in a moment will explore that in more detail. Which I think you're going to do right now, Michelle.
So Peter's outlined the extent of the problem and all the vulnerabilities. It's my job at the Commission to do something about it. What's terrorism got to do with charity regulation at all? Because some people say it's a crime, so therefore the police and security services deal with it. But actually, under charity law, if an organisation is set up with the purpose to support terrorism, it doesn't qualify as the definition of being a charity, so it wouldn't be a charity at all. But we have got some problems with that, as Peter said, in terms of whether or not you can actually prove that that was the intention. The second thing is, even if you've got a legitimate charity, if you start using the money or assets for not a legitimate purpose, it becomes a breach of trust, which is a charity law issue, which is a regulatory issue, which is where we can have some disruption and intervention impact. And the third thing is, there's a difference between abuse of a charity by someone outside of it and actually some of the instances we see of actually someone infiltrating the charity and using their position to do so. So that's how it fits into charity law. This is my analysis of where I think the problems are. Money coming in from, say, country A, from a donor that has alleged links with XYZ into charity in the UK. How much pressure has it got over it? Is it influencing what's going on with it? Are the links a problem in itself? Then there's a whole other category of within. So you've got the charity, you've got the money, actually what activities is it doing? And that can be from things like hosting websites that have extreme material on it, through to some of the use of humanitarian aid and disguising problem areas throughout that. Fundraising is a big issue, and we'll come on to that a little bit later. And then there's the out category, of particularly in an overseas context, of using overseas partners. So getting money from here into Syria inevitably uses local partners in Syria. Who are those people? Where is the money going? All of those sorts of things. Some of the challenges for us in this area are charities. Most people in this room will have something to do with a charity. You either give to a charity, you'll fundraise for a charity, you'll be one of the million trustees that there are in this country of charities, or you'll be an employee or volunteer. So charities will come up in terrorist financing investigations. So working out when it's an innocent charity with a legitimate link and when there's something a bit more suspicious is quite difficult. Evidence thresholds, it's a pretty high threshold for terrorist financing. We had a problem with the sector trying to persuade them it was an issue. There were no convictions until recently. We've got two convictions for terrorist financing involving charities. One was the Muslim Aid collections that were in Birmingham, where the chap got a legitimate licence to collect for one day, stayed on for 13 days, and collected a lot more money that actually then went out for terrorist purposes. So really difficult territory, difficult in terms of information sharing. Our counterparts in the US and Canada are tax authorities. I can give them anything that I want to from my database. They can't give me anything because of the tax perspective and data protection act sort of issues. So really not easy for us. What are we doing? We are stepping up our intervention and terrorism work. We work really closely with law enforcement agencies, security services, Met Police, other police forces, regional counter-terrorism units. That's the stats for last year in terms of how many had a, we call it a CT imprint. And I think one of the issues in this territory is quite often it will be easier to get them for a fraud or for a money laundering offence than it will for a terrorist financing offence. So we talk about having a CT imprint, even if what we're looking at and the police are looking at is a fraud issue or a money laundering issue. And interestingly, just linking in the session before, you are not disqualified from acting as a trustee if you have a conviction for money laundering, because it doesn't contain the technicality of an aspect of dishonesty or deception. That's a loophole. If you go under fraud, we can get you out. So we've got some legislation, hopefully, which will try and address some of those issues. We're increasing our monitoring, and we're also increasing our outreach work, and I'll talk to you about why we're doing that. all sorts of partners we work with. I can't possibly mention the case study of the 77 bombers without letting Peter say something about it, because he was leading it in the Metropolitan Police in terms of leading the investigation there. But two of the bombers were charity trustees of ICRA Bookshop, which was based in Leeds. And the whole connection issue between what was going on in that charity, did they use it to do what they did? Did they view extremist material there? Did they use it as a meeting place? So it's not as simple as saying terrorism is just a criminal offence and it only involves the criminal agencies. I don't know if you want to say anything else in relation to that.
Very little, other than to point out that actually this case showed very clearly the vulnerabilities of charities at all stages of terrorist activities. It wasn't only just about finance, but the ICRA bookshop was used as a meeting place, as a place for radicalisation, as a place for gathering radical materials, proselytising, and of course in due course after Khan and Tanveer returned from Pakistan, there was a clear indication that the premises were also involved in some of the attack planning. So at all stages of the enterprise, there was the risk of charitable, there was the fact of the charitable premises and property being used for this purpose.
Okay. The other final thing is not all about intervention, disruptions, regulation. We think there's a big role for the charity sector themselves to play in making their sector much more resilient to abuse. And we think if they do the same things they should be doing for fraud, and general misappropriation, they will equally protect themselves against money laundering, against terrorist financing, etc. So we've put a lot of emphasis into trying to work with outreach with the sector to get them to step up their responsibilities. Just finally, before I stop, just thought we'd throw in a few live issues for us at the minute. Syria's a real problem. Not least because of huge humanitarian need that's there, lots of charities. There are 500 charities that say they work in Syria or support Syria, and a lot of those, about 200 of them, have popped up in the last 2 years. A lot of people raising money here want it going to where it should be going. You'll know about Alan Henning and how he got out into Syria in the first place. So lots of issues about convoys, safety issues, transmission of cash, doing a lot with our border colleagues in terms of cash seizures. And it's really difficult for them. They're seeing someone saying, this is cash that's going out for humanitarian purposes. How do they tell whether or not that's true or whether or not it is actually being an excuse for getting large amounts of cash out of the country and seizing it? So we're doing some work there as well. Charity trustees are actually under a duty to report offences under Section 19 of TACT, and they haven't been doing so. So we're doing some work around that to improve reporting, and doing some safer giving alerts, some issues about convoys, etc., etc. One of the challenges for us at the minute, particularly because some of the risks are around Muslim charities, is we're getting a bit of backlash from the Muslim community and from Muslim charities about the stepping up of our work. And that's just making some of the handling issues for us particularly sensitive. The final issue, and I think it's a relevant link to perhaps what we're going to say later, is about the impact of the de-risking programme that's going on by the banks. So the impact of financial sanctions are making the banks here nervous. They have started to refuse to take charities' bank accounts to provide them services. And that's a real problem for us, because where are they going to put their millions of pounds worth of money if they cannot secure a bank account in the UK to hold those money? So it's been picked up as well by David Anderson, who is the independent review of the terrorism legislation, and he's really worried about it. So we're trying to say to Home Office and Treasury that we do need to establish a group to get some dialogue between the sector, charity sector, the banking sector, and all the regulators in the room to make sure this isn't a problem. And that's just our final thoughts, which is over to Peter.
Final thoughts. The top bullet point is really what, from the Commission's perspective, we're all about. It's about trying to enable proper, legitimate humanitarian work to continue. We all want to get the aid where it's needed. We have a humanitarian crisis all over the globe now. The public are fantastic in their generosity. The philanthropic instinct is alive and well. But we owe it to them, to the public, to do all we can to make sure that, that their money goes where they want it to go to. Multi-layered approach, for that, I think, substitute the word sophisticated, allows targeted and effective action. And criminal activity, you know, criminal prosecution is not the only way of dealing with this. The old chestnut, which we've heard many times there, risk-based approach is vital. If someone could tell me exactly what risk meant in this context, it'd be very good. Whose risk? What level of risk? Risk of what? I don't know. I think this needs to be debated and thought about. And certainly in my experience, trying to, if you identify a risk, if you take the approach that there's a thing called risk management as opposed to risk elimination, if you're managing a risk, by definition, there's some residual risk. So whose risk is that? And who's going to say, yes, that's my risk, I accept that? Very difficult to get people to do that. Close working with all the agencies is vital. We've still got a way to go, I think, in this country. We're not bad at it, we're pretty good, but there's a way to go. And we also want to support the sector from the Charity Commission. Our role is not only to regulate, but to support them as well in their endeavours. And finally, if we can disrupt something, that's a good result.
Thank you very much indeed.